fraud. In science it's rare and usually found out, but devastatingly destructive. Strangely, it's often perpetrated by the very clever who couldn't be bothered doing all that tedious lab work. Ian Freckleton, QC, is concerned. He's professorial fellow at the University of Melbourne in law and psychiatry, and here he gives three examples of famous cases.
The first is Jan Hendrik Schön, who was a researcher in condensed matter physics and nanotechnology. He received his PhD from the University of Konstanz in 1997 and then was employed by Bell Laboratories, the institution that had done much of the work toward the invention of the first laser and had been the first to use radio telescopes to detect the echo of the Big Bang. Schön's research was into the transformation of the properties of materials by the application of an electric field. He built high-performance transistors, not from the usual silicon, but from the semiconductor copper gallium selenide. He described what he maintained was the world's first organic electrical laser and the first ever light-emitting transistor. In 2001, he claimed to have built the world's smallest transistor by wiring up a single molecule and having used a thin layer of organic dye molecules to assemble an electronic circuit when acted on by an electric current. This placed Schön at the forefront of international nanotechnology research. The potential of his work was enormous, as it raised the possibility of a movement away from silicon-based electronics to organic electronics, allowing a dramatic reduction in the size of chips. As of 2001, Schön was publishing a new research paper every 8 days. This included a series of studies in both Nature and Science that promised a transformation in nanotechnology. However, clouds began to gather. Professor Lydia Sohn of Princeton University and Paul McEwen of Cornell University expressed concern about anomalies in Schön's research, including what they suggested was his use of duplicate data. Under pressure, Bell Laboratories appointed a formal committee chaired by Professor Malcolm Beasley of Stanford University to conduct an investigation into the concerns raised. One of its first acts was to request Schön to supply his raw data. He maintained, however, that he could not do so, as he had not kept his laboratory notes, and that his data files had been deleted from his computer. He also maintained that his experimental samples had been discarded or were not available for examination. The committee found Schön to have engaged in 16 instances of fraud. It concluded that he had substituted, manipulated, and fabricated data sets. Schön admitted, though, to having made mistakes. In 2004, the University of Konstanz revoked his doctoral degree. Schön took his grievances to the courts, at first successfully, but then lost on appeal. The second instance is that of social psychology professor Diederik Stapel from the Netherlands. He was one of the most prominent scholars in the psychology world. His publications were lively and tendentious. They dealt with racism, the social effects of eating meat, and a range of current social issues. He received multiple grants and prestigious awards for his scholarship. However, in 2011, three young researchers reported their suspicions of data falsification by Stapel. Others previously had described his data as too good to be true. After an exhaustive investigation of his published work, a committee made up of representatives of the three universities where Stapel had held positions concluded that the researcher's fraud extended to no fewer than 55 publications between 1996 and 2011. The committee found that Stapel had manipulated data and on other occasions created his own datasets. It observed that great harm had been occasioned by Stapel's fraud, with individuals having been demoralised and stigmatised by their association with him, and the faculties and universities where he had worked having their international reputations harmed. Fraud was also found in chapters of his doctoral dissertation, which had been awarded by the University of Amsterdam. It was withdrawn. The committee identified deficiencies in processes for enforcing standards of scientific integrity and an absence of a culture of transparency, peer review, and assumption of joint responsibility. There had been a naive delegation of trust and a failure of checks and balances, and Stapel's charismatic personality and powerful position in terms of influence and the winning of lucrative grants meant that he had escaped proper accountability. In 2015, Staple published a fascinating book entitled The Derailment, in which he described how he had yielded to the temptation to engage in intellectual dishonesty, and he described how easy it had been for him to get away with it. Chillingly, he described his methodology and how addictive his behaviour had been. This is what he said. "When I started to fake my studies, it was very, very easy. I was always alone. Nobody checked my work. Everyone trusted me. I didn't feel anything. No disgust, no shame, no regrets. I was a magician. I created my own reality, and everyone thought it was real. I was pretty good at the technical aspects of my work, which made it easy to hide what I was doing with smoke and mirrors. The research I did was never too extreme, too weird, too flashy. It was usually completely logical." Now, the third of the examples is that of Haruko Obokata. She was a scientist employed at the Riken Center for Developmental Biology in Japan. She had worked at Harvard Medical School and held a doctorate from Waseda University. She worked on the development of cells relevant to regenerative medicine, and in 2014 published two papers in Nature suggesting that stem cells could be created from a bacterial toxin or a weak acid bath. The potential for her research was the creation of highly versatile cells which could heal damaged organs, repair spinal cords, and treat neurodegenerative diseases. Her work was hailed as a potential Nobel Prize winner, and she was held up as forging a path for young female scientists in Japan. She took on celebrity status and even resided in a luxury hotel. However, resentment and suspicion grew about Obokata. Suspicions were aired that she had engaged in defective methodologies. Concern, for instance, was expressed about a genome analysis in one of her studies, which appeared to have spliced together images from two placentas, from two different experiments that looked almost the same. And images in her articles appeared to have been duplicated from her 2011 thesis, even though they related to different experiments. Moreover, attempts to reproduce her findings failed completely. An inquiry was constituted, and the resultant report denounced the quality of the laboratory notes that she provided and found that her sloppy data management lacked not only a sense of research ethics, but also integrity and the humility befitting a scientific researcher. No one could reproduce her findings. Her articles in Nature were retracted. Obokata's response was defiant, proclaiming that she rejected findings of tampering, fabrication, and plagiarism. Her supervisor committed suicide, and a spotlight was shone onto the work of her colleagues. Riken's funding was slashed. An investigation was undertaken into Obokata's doctoral dissertation next. The result was that that too was removed on the basis of her having engaged in multiple instances of plagiarism. She resigned from Riken and wrote a book entitled That Day, maintaining that one of her co-researchers was partly responsible for what had occurred and blaming pressure from the media for her inability to replicate her results. Now, it is very important, of course, to be careful about drawing conclusions from so limited a sample as three cases. However, there are some important observations that can be made in relation to the conduct of Schön, Staple, and Obokata that appear to hold good for many, not all, instances of scholarly misconduct. At a level, each of the three cases represents an instance of self-correcting science, in which the outcome of investigations into whistleblowers' complaints and concerns resulted in exposure of defective research. This sounds encouraging, but the difficulty is the damage occasioned along the journey, which in Staple's case was a long one indeed. Often individuals who engage in scientific fraud are high achievers. They are prominent in their discipline, but seek to be even more recognised for the preeminence of their scholarly contributions. Along with their drive for recognition can come charisma and grandiosity, as well as a craving for the limelight. Their productivity can border on the manic. Their narcissism will often result in a refusal to accept the manifest dishonesty and culpability of their conduct. The rationalising and self-justifying later books by Staple and Obokata are examples of this phenomenon. When a criticism is made or doubts are expressed about their work, they often react aggressively. This may result in threats to whistleblowers and an attempt to displace responsibility for their conduct onto others, including threats of defamation action. It can also generate persistent challenges in the courts, in denial of any form of impropriety. A modus operandi for fraudulent scientists can be utilisation of the collaboration of others, including across institutions. This can blur lines of individual responsibility and make it more difficult to identify who has generated particular components of research and whether there has been proper authorisation by relevant ethics committees. Research misconduct will often have multiple manifestations beyond data fraud to plagiarism and exploitation of the work of others. People rarely engage in such conduct as a one-off event and often engage in multiple forms of such dishonesty until finally they are exposed. What characterises all such behaviour is intellectual dishonesty. Most importantly, it does damage to colleagues, institutions, patients who receive treatment that is not evidence-based, and confidence in scholarship. Such conduct challenges institutions because those responsible for scientific fraud are often stars in the scholarly firmament and high earners from research funding. They put institutions, be they university departments or research laboratories, on the scholarly map, and they keep them there. Thus, exposure of their misconduct puts at risk not just the reputation of the individual, but the status of the institution, and it imperils preeminence and commercial viability. It is hardly surprising, then, that accusations of such conduct and even revelations of it are experienced by institutions as unwelcome, and that the blowtorch of scrutiny has been turned on the whistleblower all too often, rather than upon the perpetrator. Research misconduct generally matters most when it reaches the point of publication. Multiple instances of research fraud have been revealed in recent years, resulting in an unparalleled incidence of retractions in high-profile and reputable journals. The unpalatable truth is that the check and balance of peer review has repeatedly been shown to be ineffectual and has been subverted and circumvented. More and better is required if we are to reduce the extent of the phenomenon of fraudulent research. Access to data needs to be much more open, and unpreparedness to grant such access should be viewed in a sinister light, or at least as unsatisfactory, notwithstanding claims of its being private, as asserted before the European Court of Human Rights by Professor Gilberg in Sweden in relation to his ADHD research, or as commercially incompetent. This means a need for receptive, fair and prompt processes to how we respond when other scholars raise concerns about the work of a colleague. Part of this needs to be the externalisation of investigation by an Office of Scholarly Integrity modelled on the role played by the United States Office of Research Integrity. The extent of misconduct in scientific research, which is difficult to measure, but which has afflicted so many areas of scholarship, also highlights the need for changes to the culture of scientific publishing, but more particularly to the supervision of researchers and the conduct of collaborative research within science. It is inevitable that the law will play a role in such matters, at least by way of providing an appellate mechanism, but it may be that the option of prosecuting those who have fraudulently obtained funding for research which they have not undertaken bona fide will become more of an option. High-profile instances of imposition of jail terms on such persons have sent salutary shockwaves throughout science and medicine over the past decade in a number of countries. The charging and sentencing to a suspended period of imprisonment of Professor Bruce Murdoch of the University of Queensland in early 2016 in respect of fabricated research about Parkinson's disease is an example of this. However, prosecution practice in respect of research fraud is erratic. Notably, Schoen, Staple and Obokata were never charged. The challenges for science are that we must acknowledge the problem of this form of misconduct, understand better the profiles and motives of the persons who are engaging in research fraud, take assertive steps to discourage it, and take active measures to reinstitute a culture of scholarly integrity.
Ian Freckleton QC, Professorial Fellow at the University of Melbourne, with some concerns about integrity in science. Next week from the University of Queensland, concerns about young researchers and postdocs and their well-being. I'm Robin Williams.